Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back, everybody. We are about to have a conversation about the war in Iraq. It was 10 years ago today that the war with Iraq was launched under President George Bush. And there's been a lot of reflection. Actually, there has not been a lot of reflection. As you look at the press around the country, I was surprised about how little I've seen leading up to this anniversary of people kind of reflecting on what this war meant, how we got into it, what has happened since, and what it portends for the future, which is actually rather shocking when we saw the lead up and build up to the anniversary of September 11th when we were attacked. We saw press for weeks writing articles and analysis, but very little about this war in Iraq. But we're going to talk about that today here on the Mark Steiner Show. We are joined by Dr. Shibli Talami. Dr. Shibli Talami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park, a non-resident senior fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution. He has written a book called The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011, and a forthcoming book, which he'll be back on the show for, I'm sure, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and Reshaping of the Middle East. Dr. Adel Shamu is back with us. He is professor and former chairman in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Adel, good to have you back with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Richard Vatz is also in the studio. He's professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson University, blogs regularly for Red Maryland, and is back in the studio with us. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Tabat Abdallah is with us, associate professor in the Department of History at York University in Toronto, Canada, author of A Short History of Iraq from 636 to the present. And Tabat, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's just begin here. I think that I am shocked, and I don't know. Shibli, let me just start with you. You have been as taken aback as I that there has been so little coverage of this incredibly important anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq?
Undoubtedly. I think especially when you consider how painful the situation is in Iraq and how we have a president, Obama, who came to office really wanting to get our troops out of there, and to his credit, he was able to do so. But it's remarkable how the attention on Iraq has been largely tied to the presence of our troops. And what gets missed in the story is what happened to Iraq. And even when we talk about the casualties, of course, there were many American casualties in the thousands, and obviously many more thousands wounded, and we spent a lot of money. We look at it with Iraq, the lowest estimate of deaths is 100,000, go up to several hundred thousand, and still counting. So it is, you know, when we look at the what has transpired, how people evaluate the Iraq war, if you look at the past decade, and I would call it not so much the decade of post 9/11, I think we do a disservice when we call it a post 9/11 decade, because in fact post 9/11 lasted only about a few weeks. Once we started leading up to the Iraq war, which was unnecessary and untied to 9/11, the whole relationship between the U.S. and the world was really a function of the post-Iraq war era. It's not a post-9/11 era. And I think that's what gets missed in this story.
Rick?
Well, yeah, I think one of the reasons you don't hear a lot about it is that with successful military operations, you hear a lot of very positive rhetoric. If you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Democratic administration of John F. Kennedy was quite willing to talk about it. With Iraq, you know, you can always announce you've removed troops, but that always leaves something left. What is the stability of the place in which you had troops? Barack Obama can announce all he wants about the braveness, how brave he is to remove troops from Afghanistan, from Iraq, but what he cannot say is that he has created a stable Iraq. It's not hard to take out troops. You just, you know, he's the commander in chief. You could just say, I want troops to leave. The question is, what is the stability of the theater from which he has withdrawn troops?
Adel?
Well, I find a little bit more coverage in the print media than the television media and radio media. You're right. The print media, there was a lot of articles, especially op-eds and editorials about the 10th anniversary. And I think the reason is the major media, as you know, supported the invasion of Iraq. Democrat and Republican supported it. And the administration prior to the Obama administration, the Bush administration, of course, was gung-ho about it, and they told us several reasons for going into Iraq. So nobody really wants to go to bad news. And to me, the most striking, and this happens in whether it's on radio or print or in conversations or in a panel discussions I've been in, nobody talks about the death of Iraqis and the injuries of Iraqis. I mean, the Iraqis, Shibli said, minimum is 100,000. The minimum really is about 160,000. Everybody agrees, even CNN, Iraqi body count. The Ministry of Health and U.S. estimates is about 160,000. But to be very honest, somewhere around 300,000 Iraqis got killed, half a million wounded, 200,000 children died, 500,000 PTSD Iraqis. I mean, that is the extent, and no one talks about it. I was at another conference where they were talking about everything. They all the time mentioned 4,700 American death, nearly 40,000 wounded, and that's horrible. And my heart goes to their family. But at the same time, the number of Iraqis, you're talking about 20 to 50 times larger. And nobody ever. I mean, isn't there a moral responsibility when
a human
being?
I think you're right, but there is an imprecision. I mean, there is an impossibility of our knowing the number of Iraqis that have died.
There's an imprecision, but really is no uncertainty about it being large.
That's right.
Particularly when you consider the wounded. And for that matter, we also know a lot more about the refugees. We're talking about 4 million refugees between internal and external. So it is an extraordinary human tragedy. I mean, no matter how you look at it, certainly there were winners and losers. Some people were better off. Many were not. But the consequences are huge. And I wouldn't say I would disagree with the argument that some of the disaster that's still ongoing is a function of American withdrawal from Iraq. I happen to think that there is no way the American presence could have made it better. And in the end, when you are there and you aggravating a situation, postponing people coming to grips with their own realities and jeopardizing your troops, it's not the right way to go. The problem was to getting into the war in the first place and then conducting it very poorly and not having a proper planning, not ultimately pulling out. The president is to be commended for pulling out.
Talbot, let me let you jump in here.
The thing that surprises me about this dearth of coverage and discussion about Iraq is that the United States is not completely out of Iraq.
That's right.
I mean, it still has the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad. It is still extremely invested in the country in terms of its geopolitical interest, and especially concerning its tensions with Iran. In addition to that, there are several hundred American advisors in the country, plus numerous Americans who are there, not through government agencies. The Iraqis call them mercenaries, and they're there with all kinds of security organizations, providing bodyguards and whatnot for various contractors in the area. So there is still an ongoing, quite large American interest in the country. The other comment I want to make is that this, modest discussion of 10 years after the American invasion of Iraq is not only limited to the United States media. I mean, I don't follow it as much as I used to. I follow more the Iraqi media. And oddly enough, in Iraq, too, there is not much of a discussion of this. You find a couple of rather short editorials on, you know, how terrible the American invasion was and how bad it was for the country, but not any kind of major discussion of the whole presence. And I think this is an ongoing problem in Iraq. You don't find much of a discussion in Iraq about the impact of the Iran-Iraq war which was 8 years and extremely important in terms of social and economic development of the country, let alone the political impact that it's had. You don't find that much of an analysis of, you know, what the sanctions have done to the country, etc. It's as if the country really wants to forget about all that and simply focus on the here and now, the current problems.
You know, one of the ways we got into this war, and I was going back to the shows we did 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago, 11 years ago, leading up to the war. Some of you were on those shows. All of the reassurances we had about weapons of mass destruction, all the reassurances we had about the Saddam Hussein connections to
Al-Qaeda.
So I just want to play this a short clip. This is a clip of a press conference, of a press dinner, where President George Bush spoke. And this was his only statement that we know about weapons of mass destruction. And the media in America never questioned it after this in any major way. Let's play this clip of President George W. Bush speaking at the big press gala.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there. Maybe under here.
Now, what was shocking about that, I remember when it happened, we had a program around that issue with people in the press, was that here we had this major press event every year, and these are the people who are covering the White House, covering the war, covering President George Bush, covering his administration. And when he sends thousands of Americans into war, when hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are being killed and wounded, well, not that moment, but thousands are being killed and wounded, and it's a joke. And the press is laughing.
Let me say a couple things, if I may, to that.
Rick Vatz, go ahead.
First of all, I agree with you. I think that his rhetorical insensitivity, and it's not only in that on that issue, his rhetorical insensitivity is just appalling. Where I don't agree with perhaps the group is that it has to be recognized that there was a tremendous Democratic Republican consensus that there was a major problem of weapons of mass destruction that had to be overcome. You had George Tenet, Bush's CIA director, talking about this. All the United States agencies. You had agencies from around the world. You had all the major Democratic forces. You had Al Gore, Ted Kennedy, John Kerry. You had unanimity that this not only was a major problem, but it was a problem which had to be dealt with a military action. And you also, at the same time, you had Saddam Hussein not allowing the UN weapon inspectors in for reasons that he later gave would have compromised his authority if people had known that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So I think there are two points there. I think the point about the rhetorical insensitivity of George Bush is absolutely true. Every time I would hear that, it would just sicken me. And I think there's no answer to that. You're 100% correct. On the issue of the belief that George Bush acted as a lone ranger on this, I'm sorry, it just isn't true.
Well, I think what this disregards really is the amazing doctoring of intelligence. I mean, first of all, many people were uncertain, obviously. They had no idea. They didn't have independent source of information. They had to trust what the government was telling them. But what we have discovered, we know the Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame episode. We know what happened in terms of doctoring of intelligence in DOD. We know, you know, the divisions within the intelligence community. And I think the question about what was being presented to the members of Congress, what were they supposed to do? And yet, I don't agree there was unanimity. There were people who opposed it. It wasn't across the board. And one of the groups that opposed it was one that I helped put together of major international relations professor who are realists, who took an ad in September 2002 to say this war would not be in America's national interest. This included major realists who typically tend to be hard on foreign policy and on the national interest and have supported many wars. And that included Kenneth Waltz, Tom Schelling, Robert Jervis, John Mearsheimer, Steve Waltz, Steve Van Evere, people from around the country.
And what got me thinking about the idea of having this ad in the New York Times at the time was that I was in a major think tank in New York City. The president of that think tank, a very respected man, and I admire him. He's written quite a lot of stuff. And when he was dismissing the argument against the war as coming out of the liberals, and he was referring to people who are neoconservatives like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz as realists, when in fact almost all the realists opposed the war. And that's when I contacted a number of leading realists and suggested to put that into the idea, because those ideas were not there in the mainstream discourse. And the fact is, those international relations scholars paid out of their own money almost $40,000 to put a small ad in the op-ed page of the New York Times instead of being hosted across the country to write those ads against the war.
To me, this ad, this was a typical colonial war. They mustered all who could support it. Ken Pollack wrote a whole book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. Shibley basically mentioned and others, especially the neocons, they wanted to invade Iraq 10, 15 years before they invaded Iraq, before George Bush was a president. So this was really serving three general purposes. Strategic purpose was the oil and helping our friends like Jordan and Israel and Saudi Arabia by having Iraq basically no longer a source of trouble for any one of them. And it's unfortunate. The American media just swallowed the whole selling of the war to the American people. And American people were misled and lied to be very, very honest. Let me read to you from someone named Paul Pillar, who was the CIA section chief at the CIA about Iraq. He served for about 20, 30 years. He said, using the excuse that it's bad intelligence, it's nonsense, basically. And he says, the war was with the worst and most inexcusable blunders in the history of U.S. foreign policy.
So let me just read something here and ask you all to comment. A moment ago, Shibley Talhami, this is the piece you're referring to that you put in the New York Times that we pulled out today, even before we knew you were going to talk about this. And these are the points you made. Let's talk about, are these points valid or invalid in terms of where we are in 2013? He said, Saddam Hussein is a murderous despot. But no one has provided credible evidence that Iraq is cooperating with al-Qaeda. Even if Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons, he could not use them without suffering massive U.S. or Israeli retaliation. The first Bush administration did not try to conquer Iraq in 1991 because it understood that doing so could spread instability in the Middle East, threatening U.S. interests. This remains a valid concern today. The United States would win a war against Iraq, but Iraq has military options: chemical and biological weapons, urban combat that might impose significant costs on the invading forces and neighboring states. Even if we win easily, we have no plausible exit strategy. Iraq is a deeply divided society that the United States would have to occupy and police for many years to create a viable state. And the last point they made in this piece was al-Qaeda poses a greater threat to the U.S. than does Iraq. War with Iraq would jeopardize the campaign against al-Qaeda by diverting resources and attention from that campaign by increasing anti-Americanism around the globe. So that's the piece that...
Yeah, correct. Those were the points. And remember, we did this in September 2002.
Right.
When the debate was underway you could see that most of what we argued was true. I think we warned against the divisions within Iraq, about the need to occupy for a long time, the absence of an exit strategy, the fact that there was no link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and we didn't obviously have any information or any credible, independent information about nuclear capabilities, but certainly the group coming out of a realist school, but even if he did, it could still be contained.
Well, let me ask you this question about the containment issue. Saddam used weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds. I mean, this is an individual who actually you could have some information on whether he had the volition to use these weapons, because he had used these weapons. He killed. Let me just complete the point. May I just complete the point? May I just complete the point? I guess not.
Rick, just finish your point, and then Shibley, then we'll come back to topic.
He killed thousands. He killed thousands of Kurds. He used them against Iranian citizens. He had a biological weapons program. And how could anybody infer that it's okay that if he would have these weapons programs that he would not use them in that case?
Oh, I don't see the inference at all. He was a despot, and we ought to oppose. You know, we needed to oppose him and contain him, no doubt about that, and support the Iraqi people if they wanted to remove him. But the fact is, there's a big difference between the use of mustard gas and the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, we've seen lots of states do that, unfortunately, and against human rights law. But it is a big leap between that and using nuclear weapons. But the bigger point here is about the punishment issue, where you can use it against helpless people. It is sad and tragic, but when you certainly can do it more easily if they have no capacity to retaliate against you. To use nuclear weapons against those who can retaliate against you in the presence of people who are far more superior than you are, having far more nuclear capabilities than you are, it's crazy. I mean, you'd have to assume that he was suicidal, and there was no evidence that he was suicidal.
Let me just ask this other question. I think there's some other issues I want to make sure we get on the table here, and I'll let you come right back to the thing, Rick. One of the things Talbot, I think you raised this on the show months back, maybe last year or so, in the last year, I can't remember when, but that many Iraqis who live in Iraq have said that Iraq wasn't advanced by 50 years, we were thrown back 300 years.
I did.
You said that as well, Adil, on the show.
Yeah.
And so we all agree that Saddam was a vicious dictator. I mean, there's no question in anybody's mind that Saddam was not a vicious dictator, who had relationships with the United States and anybody else who was his ally at the moment, or when we needed him, he was fine with us. But I'm just curious, and let me turn to Talbot and Adil. What's the contradiction? Because one of the things happening people talk about now is that in Iraq, the world of women has been set back immeasurably.
Absolutely. Decades.
Decades. And that their healthcare system, at least in the Arab world, was probably the best.
And the religious tolerance to Christians.
And religious tolerance to Christians. And others as well, other religious
sure,
minorities.
Absolutely.
So, Talbot, talk for a minute about that contradiction.
The fascist or fascistic regime of Saddam Hussein was a regime that was based on terror and based on a militarization of society violence, internal violence, to an incredible extent. But it also had to win over some support. And it did this by appealing to notions of modernization, which go back really to ideals that were developed in the 40s and 50s with the rise of Arab nationalism, that the modernization of the Middle East based on a strict authoritarian system would bring about a more advanced role for women. It would bring about better health care, better education, more security, a wealthier middle class. And they did actually deliver on many of these points. But I am a little bit suspicious about the extent of this. I mean, Saddam Hussein's project began to unravel decades before the American invasion. It's not just because of the American invasion that this happened. And in this respect, I'm a little bit sympathetic to Dr. Dance's, you know, warnings that not all is to blame. The Americans are not all to blame for everything that's gone wrong in Iraq. For example, the advances in medicine during the late 70s, yes, Iraq was one of the most advanced in the Middle East, but actually Jordan was advancing much quicker and catching up with Iraq and then surpassing it in the 80s. And this is before the American invasion. The advances in education were already unraveling as a result of the fact that Saddam Hussein destroyed the medical college because a lot of the professors and a lot of the advanced students were leftists and tended to be opposed to the regime. And then by the mid-80s, the famed Iraqi educational system was in tatters, not because of America's position in the Middle East, but because of the internal logic of fascism and the way that it continuously has to suppress any kind of opposition, which is bound to develop as a country progresses, as people not only become interested in material gains, but also in political and cultural advances, and Saddam Hussein's regime stood opposed to this, so they had to crack down on it.
So, Tabit, let me just... The
advances, and by the way, one last thing about the position of women. One of the laws that Saddam Hussein passed in the early 80s was that all families must produce 5 children because they needed soldiers for the war. And he began to cut back on the rights of women, including the right of divorce. In addition to this, there were also laws passed, racist laws, that would not allow women to marry non-Arabs. The position of women was already beginning to unravel. If you want to talk about the glory days of women's rights in Iraq, it really goes back to the 60s and the early 70s when Iraq could boast having the first women minister in the Arab world, etc. So while it is true that as late as the end of the 80s and early 90s, still the United Nations could write a report saying that the position of Iraqi women was advanced, it was already beginning to unravel.
We just had to take a short break. We're going to come right back and pick up on what's going on inside of Iraq, what has happened since to the Middle East, Arab Spring, and more. Stay with us as we look at the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. For the 5th year in a row, Maryland's public schools have been named number one in the country by Education Week magazine. Visit MarylandEducators.org to explore what it means to invest in our students, school construction, and safety, and the educators' programs and services that make our schools a national leader. That's MarylandEducators.org. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our discussion on this 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the war with Iraq. We are joined here by Dr. Richard Vatz, professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson University, blogs regularly for Red Maryland, and who's written the book, The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Dr. Adil Shamu is with us. Adil Shamu is professor and former chairman of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow in the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. We're joined by phone. Dr. Shibli Talhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park, a non-resident senior fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution, has written many books. His forthcoming book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. And Dr. Tabit Abdullah, Associate Professor in the Department of History at York University in Toronto, Canada, and author of the book A Short History of Iraq from 1936 to the present. I would just say, just for additional identification, that both Dr. Adil Shamu and Dr. Tabit Abdullah are both originally from Iraq. So just kind of picking up from where we left off, and I think you gave a really interesting exposition here of the social history of Iraq, which I thought was important to put on the table because it sets some records straight as well. But before we go to you, Rick, Shibli, you were about to say something I could hear.
I mean, what I wanted to follow up on that is that, there's no question that, Iraq was a secular system, but it was still a dictatorship. And not only was it still a dictatorship, but if you look at what happened in the 1980s and 1990s, the damage that was done, and I'm not just talking about the military and economic damage, I'll talk about the society. Saddam Hussein inherited a state at its pinnacle. Iraq in 1980 was really on the verge of being the leading Arab state. Egypt had been expelled of the Arab League because of its treaty with Israel. Iraq was an industrial country benefiting from the oil boom years and had a lot of cash on hand. And it was really in a position to lead and to be a model. He took the country for a 7-year war that was devastating to both Iran and Iraq. He came out of it. He then invaded
Kuwait and faced a war that was devastating to Iraq. And then for another decade, Iraq faces these incredible sanctions that also hurt Iraqi society. What we've seen in those two decades, 1980s and 1990s, is really the unraveling of the middle class in Iraq. And we don't talk about that much now because we think that it's all a function of just what happened in 2003 and since. But there was a lot of devastation, much of it done through the actions of Saddam Hussein, but unfortunately the international sanctions also hurt. They hurt Iraqi society more than they hurt the regime itself. And in the end, obviously, they couldn't topple him, and the international community had to go to war, or at least the U.S. had felt it had to go to war. I think it was certainly a war that of choice, not a war of necessity.
Rick, you about to say something?
I just wanted to go back to something that was said earlier because I think it's a central issue. If United States policy should be based on the inference that Saddam, for example, and there are other examples, of course, is a rational actor, are you arguing that across the board? Does that mean that we should not try to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon because we infer that Iran is run by rational actors? I mean, this seems to me to be a very dangerous foreign policy insofar as our future is concerned, although it would save lives in the immediate sense. But is this the assumption that several people on this panel wish to argue, that we should assume that these leaders are rational actors?
If that question is intended to me, yes, by rational, I don't mean that they make always the right decision. I mean that they're cost-sensitive, that they want to survive. There is no, if you look at what the regime in Iran did, you can argue that it's fanatical. You can argue that it is doing what it's doing is not in the interest of its people. You can make all these arguments, but it's not suicidal. They had, in the end, they ended the Iraq war because it was too painful for them. If you look at their behavior, I don't think they're, you know, when you look at states that we've deterred, from Stalin to Mao, leaders that we've deterred historically, it's a dip. You know, the rationality doesn't mean that they always make the right decisions. It means that they want to live above all, and states do. They might send other people who might kill themselves for the sake of the state or for the sake of the cause, individuals, but the state itself and the institutions and the regime don't want to die. And I think, by and large, yes, I am making that argument. That doesn't mean we shouldn't stop states from having nuclear weapons. That's a different story.
I don't want to get sidetracked on this larger foreign policy issue right now. But
it doesn't mean we can't argue as well that if, in fact, they happen to develop them, it's not the end of the world. You can make both these arguments simultaneously.
So let's just have two larger questions, one about America and one about Iraq and the Middle East, that I want to kind of wrestle with here in this part of the program on this 10th anniversary of our invasion of Iraq, of the war with Iraq. When we say that Iraq has been irreparably damaged by this war and pushed back, that it has disintegrated more than – that we've hurt Iraq more than helped it, is that true? And what does that mean when people hear that? I mean, that's something that we don't see a lot in the mainstream press, but it clearly has been in some of the liberal and progressive press, in some of the European press, and some of the Arab press. But what does that mean?
The presumption, Mark, is that U.S. went to Iraq – and invaded Iraq to help Iraq against a thug. But U.S. foreign policy supported Saddam Hussein during the war with Iran. For 20 years, we had the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, went in the early 80s as a special envoy from Reagan and shook his hand and had a conversation, some kind of a deal with him. So we were not innocent bystander. We all the time wanted to neutralize Iraq from causing any trouble to our interest in Middle East, which is the oil and our friends in the region. And we thought we should do it on the cheap. When that didn't work, then I, in my opinion, I think we committed genocide and war crime by killing hundreds of thousands of people. 70% of those deaths were civilians. We assassinated intellectuals. We tortured. And the London Guardian, I don't know if Shibley has seen it or not, there are now evidence appearing that we fueled the sectarian violence in Iraq. I'm not sure the evidence are solid yet, but nevertheless, there are some fragmentary evidence that we saw. Why, if we were going to help Iraq, we did all these things, which are really a war crime?
Talbot?
Well, I agree that the American policy toward Iraq has not been helpful at all. But that's not the full picture. I think the social fragmentation and political collapse that we see today are, and I've argued this, you know, continuously on this program whenever you've had me on, Mark, it's due to four factors. First, there's the fascism and terror of Saddam Hussein. This is not something that should be underestimated. He created a culture of fear and cronyism, which continues into today. Secondly, is the reckless attitude of the regime, bringing Iraq into three devastating wars, especially the eight-year Iran-Iraq war, which created a culture of violence and an enormous amount of infrastructural destruction. The actual physical destruction is very much part of the story of what Iraq is going through today. But then you get into the last two causes, which are to a great extent the policy or have to do with the policy of the United States. The 13-year sanction on Iraq is truly one of the most criminal acts that have ever been conducted by the international community against the country. It was the most total economic boycott of any country in history, resulting in the complete destruction of the Iraqi middle class and the reduction of one of the most promising third world countries into one of the poorest. It also encouraged the development of crime and a culture of crime, which again continues into today. And lastly, when the U.S. decided to invade Iraq, and there's a whole discussion about, you know, whether the U.S. should or shouldn't, whatever. This is something that I guess Americans have to discuss with themselves. Should they become the policemen of the world? And if so, should they try to do it on the cheap as they tried with Iraq? I'm not going to participate too much in this discussion, but I would say that when the U.S. went in, the most important result of this was the destruction of the state institutions without the introduction of new ones or any kind of substitution to these state institutions. And this encouraged chaos and lawlessness. And when you put all of these four factors together, it's what is the most interesting and what's the most surprising thing for me when I observe Iraq today is not that it's fragmented and divided and there's lawlessness and there's sectarianism. For me, the most amazing result of all of this is that Iraq is still united. It's still hanging on to its unity, despite the fact of all of these terrible acts going on. And this gives me some hope, actually, for the future.
Well, I'm just kind of curious. Why do you say it's united when the main charge against Prime Minister Nouri Maliki has been his treatment of the Sunnis?
Look, there's an enormous amount of sectarianism. The Kurds are pushing more and more toward greater separation. There is a new rising authoritarianism. There are tensions between Sunnis and Shias, but equally so, there are numerous other tensions. There are class divisions within Iraq. I mean, one of the explanations, everybody in America looks at the whole political map in Iraq in terms of Kurd, Sunni, Shia. There is a whole class dimension to it. The whole reason for the existence of Muqtada al-Sadr and his Sadrist movement is essentially a class dynamic of the urban centers. There are just as much tensions and divisions within the Shia community and within the Kurdish community. So there are numerous divisions. But what I'm saying is that overall, the country is still united. There's still a single country. There's still a single government. There's still a single currency. all of the different forces, all of the different competing forces, including the most separatists, the Kurds, still believe that it would be extremely risky to completely divide the country. And this, to me, is the most surprising result of all of this. I would expect that these kind of three decades of such a hammering of the political and social institutions of the country would have fragmented it by now, as it did the Sudan, for example, or as it did Ethiopia before. But Iraq is still holding on to its unity.
I hasten to say that the greatest danger to Iraq is, and the whole Middle East, the Shia-Sunni fault line and the fighting among them, which is really extremely dangerous for Middle Eastern countries.
I think there's a lot of things that should be clarified about this. I don't know if we have a lot of time, but to
about 15 minutes. So go ahead, David.
Yeah, but all right. First of all, it's so easy to just throw these terms, Sunni Shia. What does that mean anyway? In Iraq, there are huge tribal formations, for example. Many of them are mixed. For example, the Shammar tribe, one of the largest tribes, predominantly Sunni, but about 30% of the tribal members are Shia. They recognize tribal leadership, and they also respect religious leadership. If you look at one of the biggest Shia tribal confederations, the Muntafaq tribe of the south, its sheikhs, its chieftains, have historically been Sunni. And this was part of the compromise that was reached in the 18th century by the different tribes that formed this confederation, that they would have Sunni tribal leadership. Likewise, if you look at some of the specifics, among the most implacable foes of al-Maliki today, who is supposed to be the representative of the Shias, is Muqtada al-Sadr on the one hand and Ayatollah Sistani on the other, both well-known Shia leaders. Among the foremost supporters of the unity of Iraq and a figure that has reached out to Muqtada al-Sadr in particular is Sheikh Abdul Malik al-Sa'di, one of the leading Sunni leaders. So this issue of Sunni-Shia tension, it's there, it's true, it's historic, but it's not the complete story. There are many other factors involved, and there is a sense of Iraqi nationalism that has survived despite all these destructions, not because of some idealism, but because of the conviction of many of the leading personalities that the only way they can save themselves is by adopting a logic of Iraqi nationalism.
Nothing so, you said that I disagree with, Thabit, and doesn't contradict what I said.
Let me kind of shift gears a little bit in the time we have, some of the time we have left. Now, I want to talk a bit about and to come back to Iraq if we can internally and what's happened there. But I also want to talk about what has this done to the United States and our policies, and what it has done to. Whether it's from the very beginning with Attorney General Yu and the kind of walking away from Geneva Conventions and what happens when you capture prisoners to a lack of transparency in government from George Bush all the way through President Barack Obama in these wars to the other issues we've been raised. I think this raises there are a lot of – and then the subsequent Arab Spring and America's – response to it, and America's kind of, and the West's almost inability to figure out how to respond to things other than bombing in Libya and French troops now in Mali, but not knowing how to deal with Bahrain and its authoritarian government because we need Bahrain. So it should be, let me let you start this to round off and go to Adil and then over to Rick and
well,
Talbot.
Let me start with a couple of points that we need to keep in mind. Number one is that the anger with America over the past decade that we've not only documented in the Arab world and Muslim countries, but in Europe, in Africa, in much of the world, sort of the loss of America's prestige and influence. When you look at that, it was entirely a function of the Iraq War, not of 9/11. If you look at how much sympathy the U.S. received right after 9/11, it's exemplified by Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela, we invited him to give my Anwar Sadat lecture at the University of Maryland in November 2001, right after, just as the American forces were going into Afghanistan. He gave a lecture here saying, I support America's right to go after Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Nelson Mandela, who opposes all these superpowers, meddling in around the world, he understood that America was attacked. And within 2 weeks, he gives back, and we start talking about the Iraq War, and he starts being a critic of American foreign policy just like everybody else. So first of all, it has been the single most damaging event to American foreign policy and American standing in the world. Second, economically, if you look at what happened, not so much just the direct investment in the Iraq War itself, but also the consequences of it, that if you look at the gap between China and the U.S., it has narrowed most during, since the Iraq War, than in any other period before. Third, when you look at what happened in the region, no question that the rising power of Iran has been largely a function of the weakening of Iraq. Iraq, hopefully it'll come together. We all hope that it will someday find its path and its people will remain united and have a democracy. But in the foreseeable future, Iraq will not be a state of wait no matter what. And so what has been done in the Gulf is that essentially Iranian power has increased, and we had put a lot of the Arab allies under pressure, and the U.S. is now scrambling to find a way to deal with Iran. It's a direct function of that. Third, you wonder whether the anger in the Arab Spring most certainly wasn't a function of a model in Iraq. No one in Cairo or in Tunisia was inspired by what happened in Baghdad. In fact, rulers in the Arab world may have delayed the pressure by saying, would you rather have Baghdad or would you rather have Cairo? Well, what happened is the anger was so deep in the Arab world against the war that they saw their rulers, who knew that it wasn't even good for them as rulers, not just for the people, and in the end went along with the U.S. because the U.S. was a dominant power. And in my own opinion, that anger may have contributed to the anger that drove ultimately the Arab Spring. Beyond the anger with the rulers, yes, but the anger with the rulers as subcontractors of foreign powers was a very powerful, impetus into what transpired. And final thought is, I wonder whether if the Arab uprising started without the Iraq War, they probably would have started, what year, we don't know, but whether they would have swept Saddam Hussein anyway, just like sweeping other dictators in the region, without having to go to war, with the Iraqi people doing it their way, without the use of airplanes and missiles that kill thousands.
Rick, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just think that, again, I do not have the expertise of some of the others on this panel with respect to these particular countries internally. But I think that in foreign policy, the United States' credibility has taken a tremendous hit. I think that Iraq is beholden to Iran, and I think there's a lot of evidence for that. I think we seem to be reluctant to do anything about Iran. We certainly seem to be reluctant to do anything about Kim Jong-un. And I think that these countries now, as opposed to former presidents, now assume that the United States will not take action regardless of the geopolitical situation. And I think that believing that America will not act regardless is an extremely dangerous situation, and it's manifesting itself again with Iraq, with Iran, with North Korea, and I think it's tremendously dangerous. And I think, again, the last thing I'll say on that is that when Barack Obama announces the success of his policy in terms of taking out troops without referencing the stability of the countries that he's left, I think that that is a telltale sign of that.
Adil?
I think Iraq has gone backward about 30 years, has been destroyed. The people of Iraq have suffered tremendously. An injustice was done to them. I think it's a case of war crime. The only reason a war crime tribunal is not forthcoming is because America is the only superpower in the world and they have a tremendous influence. And that, to me, shows the lack of moral leadership in the world as a whole, which will perpetuate the al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-like in different forms, people who are angry about United States policy in their their region. And I don't see us, including Obama, despite some positive things he's done, overall change the policy. We still support the thugs in Bahrain government. We still support other regimes like in Egypt. As long as the military is our friends, heck with the government, because that's our ultimate safety valve. So I think our foreign policy is really has not changed dramatically under Obama. He still used drones to kill innocent people or some bad ones, maybe 1%, 5%. But 95% are women and children and regular civilians. So I'm very pessimistic within the next decade.
Tabit, I know that you don't focus on U.S. policy a lot.
No, it's all right. I'll throw my I'll throw in a comment here. I agree with my colleagues with much of what they said. For me, you know, I would say that if the United States should learn anything from this, it's not to revert back to complete isolationism. I think that's impossible. And some of the anti-war activists in the United States who propose this, I think, are being preposterous, really. This is not going to happen. An American involvement in the world should be based, if they are to learn anything from the Iraqi debacle, it is that it must be based on a sense of respect for local actors, for the people in the regions that they are to be involved in. One of the biggest problems of American involvement in Iraq is that they approach it with a very heavy-handed, arrogant posture, in which they didn't really listen to even the anti-Saddam groups who were making all kinds of recommendations and suggestions about how the whole operation must be carried out. The United States simply must realize that it's not as powerful as it thinks it is. Once again, you know, if Iraq has taught America something, it is that it's not as powerful as it thinks it is. It cannot just go into a region and socially engineer a society into the image that it wants. It needs local allies. It needs to be in seeking these local allies, it must compromise many of what it thinks must be done. So when it considers, you know, its policies vis-a-vis Korea or Iran or any other country, hopefully it will take into consideration these points.
Rick, you have a final thought here, but 30
seconds. I just
want to
say that when you say the United States shouldn't go back to complete isolationism, you give away some of what's the problem. That we have changed the norm so much that we're now talking about not going back to complete isolationism.
Yes, yeah, true.
Our drones over Mali and other places, it's not isolationism.
Yeah, but that is.
You know, the history of American foreign policy is swinging back and forth, and obviously it's generally when you have a devastating war, as happened after Vietnam, you had the Vietnam syndrome, but the American people want their country to play a role in the world. I think it's been very clear, and I think it still is, and it's more clear than ever because of the economic and political interdependence. It's just that people don't want American unilateralism, and they don't want it to be through the use of force first and foremost.
And Dr. Shibli Talami, you've had the last word, at least for today, and I appreciate you being on the show, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park. His forthcoming book, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Thank you so much once again for joining us.
Pleasure.
Dr. Tawhid Abdallah, always great to have you with us, Associate Professor in the Department of History at York University in Toronto, author of The Short History of Iraq, 636 to the present. Tawhid, always great. I hope you feel better soon, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And my old friend Rick Vetch, thank you for coming to the studio, professor at the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Towson. His latest book is the only authentic book of persuasion. Dr. Adel Shamu, professor and former chairman of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at University of Maryland School of Medicine, associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies and senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
My pleasure, and thank you.
Thank you all so much, and we'll continue
thank
this
you.
Conversation. Good to have you all with us. Thank you so much for joining us. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews and Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.